The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We are reading this week from the July 20th, 2018 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week has deep red background, and in the foreground is the Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Just behind him are the four other conservative justices on the court. They're all in their robes. The title of the cover this week is The Fifth Vote: Would Kavanaugh Enable Supreme Court Conservatives to Overturn Roe? And I believe that is the subject of the main story and the controversy of the week, so we'll go right into it. The main stories and how they were covered. Kavanaugh faces rough confirmation battle. What happened? Senate Democrats this week launched what will be a fierce partisan battle to block the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh, the U.S. Court of Appeals judge selected by President Trump to succeed longtime swing vote Justice Anthony Kennedy on the U.S. Supreme Court. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky hailed Kavanaugh, a favorite of the Republican legal establishment and a former law clerk of Kennedy's, as one of the most thoughtful jurists in the country, citing his intellect, experience, and exemplary judicial temperament. But Minority Leader Chuck Schumer spoke for many Democrats in promising to oppose Judge Kavanaugh's nomination with everything I have, adding, "The stakes are simply too high for anything less." Kavanaugh's views on abortion rights, access to health care, voting rights, and presidential immunity, informed by his experience working for independent counsel Ken Starr's investigation of President Bill Clinton, will be a major issue throughout the Senate confirmation hearings. After his experience in the Starr investigation and later working as a staff secretary to President George W. Bush, Kavanaugh wrote a Law Review article saying Congress should pass legislation that would prevent presidents from being distracted by civil litigation, criminal investigation, or possible prosecution while in office. He said he'd realized in working for Bush that investigations take the president's focus away from his or her responsibilities to the people and should be deferred until the president leaves office. Democrats seized on that article to charge that Trump selected Kavanaugh because he's likely to rule in the president's favor if Trump refuses to respond to a subpoena by special counsel Robert Mueller or shuts down the investigation. Not only did Mr. Kavanaugh say that a president should not be subpoenaed, he said a president shouldn't be investigated, Schumer said. Kavanaugh is seen as an originalist jurist in the mold of Justice Clarence Thomas and former Justice Antonin Scalia. In his rulings, Kavanaugh, an observant Catholic, has been a staunch defender of religious liberty and has frequently challenged the Environmental Protection Agency over regulations imposed on industry. He notably dissented in a 2011 decision upholding Washington, D.C.'s ban on semi-automatic assault-style rifles, arguing that the prohibition was unconstitutional. The GOP's 51-49 majority makes Kavanaugh's confirmation likely, particularly if red state Democrats feel political pressure to vote for him. What the editorial said: in supporting Trump, the Republican Party made a deal with the devil. The Supreme Court for your soul, said the Chicago Sun-Times. Mainstream conservatives overlooked every reprehensible thing about Trump in hopes he'd fill court vacancies with justices like Scalia. By nominating a tried and true conservative like Kavanaugh after already putting Neil Gorsuch on the court, Trump has made good on his campaign promise. By replacing Kennedy's unpredictable moderate views with doctrinaire conservatism, said the Washington Post, Kavanaugh could drastically shift the court's tenuous ideological balance. But senators of both parties should press Kavanaugh to clarify his views on executive privilege and extract an ironclad commitment that he will act as a check on the president. What the left fears most is losing the court as its preferred legislature, said the Wall Street Journal. But Kavanaugh has demonstrated judicial modesty by deferring to presidential authority regardless of the White House occupant, and will help restore the Supreme Court to its proper, more modest role in American politics and society. What the columnist said, literally any nominee would have been portrayed by the left as a science fiction villain, said Emily Jahinsky in the Washington Examiner. Before the nomination was even announced, the Women's March prematurely sent out a boilerplate press release claiming XX would be a death sentence for thousands of women, inadvertently exposing modern feminism's hollow and reflexive fear-mongering. It's hard to imagine Kavanaugh's expansive view of presidential power didn't appeal to President Trump, said Caroline Fredrickson and Norman Eisen in the New York Times. The nominee's past writings suggest he agrees with Trump's lawyers' bizarre argument that a president cannot legally obstruct justice by shutting down an investigation over which he has authority. Trump wants to make the Mueller witch hunt go away, said Dahlia Lithwick and Slate.com. So he chose the guy who had the most to say about imperial presidents. Trump's base of evangelicals wanted him to pick religious conservative Amy Coney Barrett, but he ignored them. That's why his decision to select Kavanaugh makes him look guilty. With little wiggle room in a narrowly divided Senate, the confirmation vote will come down to a few key players, said Josh Voorhees, also in Slate.com. Among them, pro-choice Republican Senators Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, a iconoclastic libertarian who has voiced concerns that Kavanaugh is too deferential to the executive branch, particularly in matters of surveillance, and red state Democrats such as Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Claire McCaskill of Missouri, and Doug Jones of Alabama. Kavanaugh's fate will rest with these senators. And the controversy of the week, also regarding the Supreme Court nomination, says Supreme Court is Roe now doomed. Brett Kavanaugh gives the Supreme Court's conservative wing the fifth vote it needs to overturn Roe, said Dylan Matthews in Vox.com. In the mild-mannered Kavanaugh, President Trump has nominated a highly confirmable justice who will help the president fulfill his campaign pledge to overturn Roe versus Wade, the 1973 decision legalizing abortion in all 50 states. A Roe reversal would mean each state could decide whether to ban abortion, and more than 20 Republican-controlled states surely would. In previous rulings and public comments, Kavanaugh has praised former Justice William Rehnquist's dissent in Roe, stated that the court shouldn't make social policy, and recently argued that the government had the right to block a pregnant 17-year-old unauthorized immigrant from obtaining an abortion while in detention on the grounds that the government has permissible interest in favoring fetal life. We are about to find out exactly why the right was so worked up over the court for so long, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. Kavanaugh's nomination to replace swing voter Justice Anthony Kennedy means Roe is already gone. Oh, calm down, said Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post. Roe v. Wade isn't going anywhere. While still controversial, the ruling is now so entrenched in our culture that 67% of voters want to see it preserved. Does any justice, other than Clarence Thomas, really want to be credited with upending settled law and causing massive societal upheaval? As even honest pro-choicers admit, Roe invented a right that isn't in the Constitution, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. But the ruling is also 45 years old and embedded in American law. Today, pregnant women can perform abortions at home with easily obtainable medications, and trying to ban these drugs would create an enormous social uproar. Chief Justice John Roberts doesn't want a major partisan backlash against his court. He and other court conservatives may share pro-life personal views, but they are checked by the doctrine of stare decisis. Established legal precedents must be respected if at all possible. Besides, said Carol Sanger in the New York Times, overturning Roe would be downright dangerous for the Republican Party. Overnight, the GOP would lose the super fuel that's been driving its voters to the polls since 1973. That energy would instantly transfer to angry Democrats, especially millennials. One thing that wouldn't change, said Jennifer Wright in the New York Post, is the annual number of abortions in America. In nations that ban abortion outright, the abortion rate is actually higher than in nations that don't, with desperate women risking their lives with back alley abortionists or grisly at-home procedures. In the pre-Roe era of 1967, the Guttmacher Institute has estimated there were 829,000 illegal or self-induced abortions in the U.S., compared with 652,000 legal ones in 2014. Our choice, in other words, is not between abortion and no abortion. Our choice is between a safe procedure and a dangerous one. Even in the unlikely circumstance that Roe is overturned, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com, the vast majority of states would guarantee some degree of access to abortion. Why? Because that's what most voters want. The truth is that we pro-lifers can't win this battle through the courts. If we are to convince other Americans that it's wrong to kill unborn lives, that battle has to be won in the culture from the ground up. In our Good Week, Bad Week segment, seems that it was a good week for eco-terrorism. After Al-Shabaab, the Somalia-based militant Islamist group that has massacred thousands of civilians, announced a ban on plastic bags in its territory because the bags pose a serious threat to well-being of both humans and animals. It was a good week for karma. After a group of rhino poachers who broke into a South African animal preserve were eaten by a pride of lions. Officials said they found the remains of what appeared to be three poachers, along with a high-powered rifle, an axe, and some shoes and clothing. Everything was very spread out, the officials noted. And it was a good week for Darcy, a 3-year-old French bulldog who experienced breathing problems on a JetBlue domestic flight and was revived when flight attendants applied an oxygen mask. It actually fit her face really well, said owner Michelle Burt, because she's got a round face. But it was a bad week for rest stops at 35,000 feet, with the news that airline restrooms are getting even smaller as profit-hungry carriers make room for more seats. The tiny restrooms contribute greatly to the general decline of the in-flight experience, said a flight attendants group. It was a bad week for the new protocols after an Iranian general blamed Israel for the ongoing drought in Iran. alleging that Jews are working to ensure clouds entering Iranian skies are unable to release rain. And finally, it was a bad week for show-offs, with a pair of new polls revealing that up to 99% of heterosexual women would prefer not to be seen with their partner while he's wearing a form-fitting Speedo-style bathing suit. Our results show that some things really are better left to the imagination, said Matthew Smith of Pollster YouGov. And while we're here, we'll read a boring but important item. White House halts Obamacare payments. The Trump administration announced this week it would suspend risk adjustment payments to health insurers, an essential component of the Affordable Care Act designed to stabilize insurance markets. Insurers say the move will result in significantly higher premiums in 2019 for individuals and small business owners. The payments, which totaled $10.4 billion last year, transfer funds from insurers with healthier patients to those with sicker, costlier enrollees. The administration's decision follows a ruling by a federal judge in New Mexico who said the formula for calculating payments is flawed. But rather than freezing payments in New Mexico alone, the administration stopped them indefinitely nationwide. The title of our briefing page article this week is Canadian-American Relations. President Trump has opened a rift with one of America's closest allies, but things have been worse. Are the two countries close? The strong neighborly ties between Canada and the U.S. are virtually unprecedented in world history. The two nations share the world's longest border, which is mostly undefended except for civilian law enforcement. And the American and Canadian militaries work hand in hand for joint defense through the North American Aerospace Defense Command, or NORAD, N-O-R-A-D. The U.S. and Canada also have the largest trading relationship of any two nations in the world, exchanging $1.9 billion in goods and services every day. The nation's electrical grids are completely integrated as well. Nevertheless, Canadian-American relations appear to be at their lowest point in years, thanks to President Trump's decision to levy tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum imports in the interest of, quote, national security. The tariffs, as well as Trump's personal attacks on Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, have enraged Canadians. The idea that we're some national security threat is just preposterous, said David Perry, a senior analyst at the Canadian Global Affairs Institute. Have we always been allies? No. In fact, Canada's identity was forged in its opposition to its southern neighbor. During the American Revolution, Britain's Canadian colonies rebuffed invitations to join the revolt against the crown. And Canada ultimately became a haven for some 40,000 loyalist refugees fleeing persecution at the hands of the victorious patriots. When hostilities broke out again between the U.S. and the British in the War of 1812, American troops invaded Canada, expecting to be greeted as liberators, only to be beaten back by British and Canadian troops. The war contributed greatly to Canada's emerging sense of self. Travel to Ontario, which saw much of the cross-border fighting, and you'll find monuments celebrating the triumph of Canadian arms over the invading Americans. Did relations improve after that? Somewhat. The U.S. never invaded Canada again, and the border was largely demilitarized in successive treaties between Britain and the U.S. But disputes over the border persisted throughout the early 19th century as the U.S. pushed westward. After the American Civil War, some Republicans demanded that Britain cede all of Canada as reparation for supporting the Confederacy. Fears of another American invasion helped lead to the creation of the Dominion of Canada on July 1, 1867, now celebrated as Canada Day, which united the colonies of Canada, New Brunswick, and Nova Scotia into one semi-autonomous confederation within the British Empire. It was the beginning of the modern Canadian nation. When did tensions subside? Canadian-American cooperation during World War II and the emerging threat of the Soviet Union ended the cross-border conflicts. Nevertheless, there have been flashes of disagreement over the decades, especially regarding American foreign policy. Some 30,000 Americans fled to Canada to avoid the draft during the Vietnam War, which Canada opposed. It also refused to join the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. Canadians have long been leery of being dominated by their much larger neighbor, which has a population nearly 10 times that of Canada. Former Canadian Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau famously compared his country's relationship with the U.S. to a mouse sitting next to a sleeping elephant. "No matter how friendly and even-tempered is the beast," he said, "one is affected by every twitch and grunt." What are Trump's complaints? He says America is being treated unfairly, falsely claiming that the country runs a trade deficit with Canada. Trump is particularly angry about Canada's fierce protection of its dairy farmers. Canada sets production quotas for dairy, eggs, and poultry products to keep prices stable and guarantee farmers a steady income, while charging tariffs of up to 270% on imported dairy products. The Trump administration wants Canada to open up its dairy market as part of the ongoing renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement. "It's not about Trump and Trudeau," said former American diplomat Stephen Kelly. "This has been an irritant for many years." What do Canadians think? Canadians point out that the U.S. also heavily subsidizes its dairy industry by about $22 billion a year. Canada offered to open up its dairy market to join the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, but Trump pulled out of the agreement in one of his first acts as president. Historically, Canadians have had a positive view of the U.S., but that's changing under the Trump administration. For the first time in more than three decades, more Canadians have an unfavorable view of the U.S. than have a favorable one. Some Canadians are even boycotting U.S. products. Trump's hardline immigration policy is also rubbing Canadians the wrong way. The U.S. Border Patrol recently boarded 10 Canadian fishing boats in disputed boundary waters to look for illegal immigrants, triggering howls of protest from Canadians. "Not surprised to see the Americans trying to push people around," said Lawrence Cook of New Brunswick's Grand Manan Fishermen's Association. "Typical American bullies. The price of a trade war. Who would win a trade war between the U.S. and Canada? Arguably, no one. Canada and the U.S. export almost exactly the same value of goods and services to each other every year. Around $670 billion. Canada, however, is likely to suffer more in the long run because it's so heavily dependent on trade with the U.S. Canada's trade with the U.S. is worth as much as its trade with all other countries combined. Canada exports as much to the U.S. in a single month as it sends to the 28 countries of the European Union in an entire year. But Americans will also pay a price. Canada is the top export market for 35 U.S. states, and 9 million U.S. jobs depend on exports to its northern neighbor. If President Trump follows through on threats to impose a 25% tariff on Canadian-built cars, it would immediately rebound on the American auto industry, whose supply chain is inextricably intertwined with Canadian auto plants. "It should worry everyone," said Bruce Hayman, a former U.S. ambassador to Canada. We're into the best columns of the week. We'll take a couple from the U.S. this week. The first one, Congress must reclaim its war powers. Even in this bitterly polarized age, most conservatives and liberals now agree that Congress is too weak, said David French. Over the years, the legislative branch has generally abdicated its responsibilities in favor of an ever more powerful, quote, imperial presidency. This is not only bad for the constitutional order, it has also damaged the country's civic fabric by making every presidential election feel like a life or death struggle for total control of the federal government. It's past time for Congress to reassert itself as an equal branch, and a good place to start would be with its war-making powers. The Constitution gives Congress the sole power to declare war, but Presidents Obama and Trump have both claimed a de facto green light to launch limited military strikes without congressional authorization. U.S. troops are currently engaged in military operations across the Middle East, Asia, and Africa on the basis of two congressional post 9/11 military authorizations that are more than 15 years old. That's absurd, and Congress should reclaim its proper constitutional authority over the decision to go to war. It's the best way to give the public a greater voice in the most consequential decisions any government can make. Weinstein trial will shame Hollywood. Prepare for, quote, Harvey's revenge, said Stephen Galloway. Disgraced movie producer and accused serial sexual predator Harvey Weinstein is facing charges that could send him to prison for life. But his lawyers will try to put as many enablers and Hollywood itself on trial. And the results may be embarrassing. Weinstein insists he never engaged in anything but consensual relations, and his lawyers will attempt to prove that everyone, including his female accusers, knew the rules of the game. Sexual favors in return for a chance at stardom. The defense will argue that the casting couch is an old Hollywood tradition and seek to implicate dozens of men and women who stood by and let terrible things happen because they didn't have the nerve to stand up to him or persuaded themselves this was just the way business was done. Weinstein's defense will be, how could there be any genuine victims when everyone knew what he was up to? It's a cynical argument, but it's true that many people in Hollywood were complicit in his crimes. Other power brokers, agents, and everyone in the industry knew Weinstein could butter their bread if they buttered his. Who were they to challenge Hollywood's most established conventions? This is a European column from Bulgaria. Those who haven't left are dying. The bells are tolling Bulgaria's death, said Peter Ivanov. This country had nearly 9 million residents in 1989. But since the fall of the Iron Curtain, when our borders opened and mass immigration to the West became possible, we have been hemorrhaging citizens. And now Bulgaria's population has plunged below 7 million, a loss of 22% in barely three decades. The brain drain has robbed us of our young people, the very people who should have been birthing the next generation of Bulgarians. All we have left are the old and feeble. The result is that now Bulgaria's mortality rate is the highest in the world, higher than those of countries such as Syria and Afghanistan, where war is raging. We are melting away even more rapidly than Swaziland, where there's an AIDS epidemic. Bulgaria is shedding 220 people every day. Yet not all groups are shrinking equally. The Roma birth rate is much higher than the ethnic Bulgarian one. So while we lose 13 Bulgarians every hour, we also gain 4 Roma. It won't be long before ethnic Bulgarians are a minority in our own country. This is no longer just a demographic catastrophe. We can pronounce Bulgaria clinically dead. The heart may beat a bit longer, but the soul is gone. We'll be right back. in-depth article this week, The Last Word, goes in a little different direction. It's titled, The Secretive Firms Behind Your Glasses. If you have been wearing glasses for years, said journalist Sam Knight, you may be surprised to discover that you see the world thanks to two giant companies that you likely have never heard of. Almost everyone wears glasses at some point in their lives. In developed countries, the rule of thumb is that around 70% of adults need corrective lenses to see well. And over the last generation, just two companies have risen above all the rest to dominate the industry. The lenses in my glasses, and yours too most likely, were made by Essilor, E-S-S-I-L-O-R, a French multinational that controls almost half the world's prescription lens business and has acquired more than 250 other companies in the past 20 years. There is a good chance, meanwhile, that your frames were made by Luxottica, L-U-X-O-T-T-I-C-A, an Italian company with an unparalleled combination of factories, designer labels, and retail outlets. Luxottica pioneered the use of luxury brands in the optical business, and one of the many powerful functions of names such as Ray-Ban, which is owned by Luxottica, or Vogue, also owned by Luxottica, or Prada, whose glasses are made by Luxottica, or Oliver Peoples, also Luxottica, or of outlets such as LensCrafter, the largest optical retailer in the U.S., or Sunglasses Hut, both owned by Luxottica, is to make the marketplace feel more varied than it actually is. Between them, Essilor and Luxottica play a central, intimate role in the lives of a remarkable number of people. Around 1.4 billion of us rely on their products. Last year, the two companies had a combined customer base that is somewhere between Apple's and Facebook's, but with none of the hassle and scrutiny of being well known. Now they are becoming one. On March 1st, regulators in the EU and the US gave permission for the world's largest optical companies to form a single corporation, which will be known as Essilor Luxottica. The new firm will not technically be a monopoly. Essilor currently has around 45% of the prescription lens market, and Luxottica 25% of the frames. But in seven centuries of spectacles, there has never been anything like it. The new entity will be worth around $50 billion, sell close to a billion pairs of lenses and frames every year, and have a workforce of more than 140,000 people. No one is exactly sure what it is about early 21st century urban living, the time we spend indoors, the screens, the color spectrum and LED lighting, or the needs of aging populations, but we are becoming a lens-wearing species. The need varies depending where you go, because different populations have different genetic predispositions to poor eyesight, but it is there and growing. In Nigeria, around 90 million people, or half the population, are now thought to need corrective eyewear. There are actually two things going on. The first is a largely unreported global epidemic of myopia, or nearsightedness, which has doubled among young people within a single generation. For a long time, scientists thought myopia was primarily determined by our genes. But about 10 years ago, it became clear that the way children were growing up was harming their eyesight, too. The effect is starkest in East Asia. In the 1950s, between 10% and 20% of Chinese people were nearsighted. Now, among teenagers and young adults, the proportion is more like 90%. In Seoul, 90% of 19-year-old men are myopic, many of them severely. At the same time, across the developing world, a slower and more complex process is underway. As populations age and urbanize and move indoors to work, in 2018, an estimated 2.5 billion people, mostly in India, Africa, and China, are thought to need spectacles, but have no means to have their eyes tested or to buy them. Eye health campaigners call it the largest untreated disability in the world. It is also a staggering business opportunity. Essilor and Luxottica know this. Leonardo Del Vecchio is the patron, legend, and haunting spirit of the global eyewear business. His father died before he was born, his mother was poor, and he was raised in an orphanage in wartime Milan, where he went to work as a metal engraver at age 14. In 1961, Del Vecchio opened a workshop in the town of Agordo in the Dolomite Mountains. He was 25. The valley around Agordo was emptying out because of the closure of a mine, and the town was giving away land to companies that were willing to move there. Del Vecchio asked for 3,000 square meters on the riverbank to build a factory to make parts for spectacles. Over the next half century, Del Vecchio grew his company, which was called Luxottica, into the world's greatest maker of glasses frames. He sought to control every element in the business, from the metal alloys of the hinges to the stores where eyewear is sold. In a series of audacious takeovers, Del Vecchio acquired brands such as Ray-Ban, Oakley, and Persol, and signed contracts with fashion houses such as Armani, Ralph Lauren, and Chanel. He built factories in China and acquired vision insurance schemes in the U.S. and retail chains on four continents. Since 1994, Del Vecchio has been Italy's highest individual taxpayer and the country's second richest man. A few years ago, people thought his career had run its course. But in January 2017, at age 81, Del Vecchio announced the greatest deal of his life, in which he also secured the final missing part for his frames, the lenses, when Luxottica agreed to merge with Essilor. "He wants to do this merger," a former colleague said, thinking he will leave behind this great company that will last for 100 years. For the company's 30th anniversary in 1991, Del Vecchio renovated some 15th century stables in the middle of Agordo and opened a private glasses museum. The first glasses were almost certainly made in northern Italy in the last decades of the 13th century. But for centuries after their invention, spectacles and other magnifying lenses were mostly rejected by medical men who recommended potions to correct people's eyesight instead. In The Perfect Oculist, written in 1666, Robert Turner, a London doctor, recommended turtle's blood and the powdered head of a bat for the treatment of squints. For weak eyesight, you might try wearing cow's eyes around your neck. The cabinets in Del Vecchio's museum trace the evolution from leather frames that and hinged bridges of the Middle Ages to the gold rims of the 19th century. No one knows why it took 400 years to put arms on glasses, which are known as temples, and were pioneered in London in the early 18th century, so they finally sat comfortably on people's ears. For its first 25 years, Luxottica stayed on the wholesale side of the industry, selling its glasses through optometrists to the public. In the 1990s, however, Del Vecchio decided he wanted a retail network too. First, he got Luxottica listed on the New York Stock Exchange, an almost unheard-of move for a mid-sized Italian business. The listing laid the groundwork for Del Vecchio's $1.4 billion hostile takeover of U.S. Shoe, a conglomerate that owned LensCrafters, the country's largest optical chain, in 1995. On paper, the deal appeared outlandish. U.S. Shoe was five times larger than Luxottica, and its board did not want to sell. Having its own shops would also put Luxottica in direct competition with the thousands of optometrists it had been supplying for decades. But the deal got done. Del Vecchio promptly broke up U.S. Shoe until all that was left were the LensCrafters stores, which he proceeded to fill with Luxottica frames. This is exactly the formula they have used ever since, said Jeff Cole, the former CEO of Cole National Corporation, an even larger optical retailer that sold out to Luxottica in 2004. The formula means that when you or I walk into a LensCrafters or a Sunglass Hut or Oticus Carol, which has 950 branches in Brazil, or a Zulong Glasses in Shanghai, or a Ming Long store in Hong Kong, around 80% of the frames on display will be made by Luxottica. In the factory in Agordo, I saw a dual-armed robot pinning together the front and temples of Ray-Ban wayfarers, and basket after basket of metal frames being dunked in a series of chemical baths to coat and color them. Glasses may appear to be relatively simple objects, but they involve between 180 and 230 manufacturing stages. Luxottica can take a pencil sketch to global production in about 3 weeks. We are a closed loop, said Giorgio Striano, Luxottica's chief operating officer. Taking into account all the different colors and face shapes, Japanese noses are not the same as Latino noses. Luxottica has around 27,000 models in production at any one time. Its plants turn out 400,000 pairs of frames per day. I asked Striano if any other company came close. I think nobody, he said. Delvecchio's second great strategy is the one that changed the nature of the optical business, and that was to combine it with the fashion industry. In 1988, he signed a licensing deal with Giorgio Armani. Until then, consumers in Europe and America who wanted fancy spectacles had to rely on staid industry names such as Zeiss, Rodenstock, and Silhouette. After the Armani deal, they could buy Prada, Gucci, or Chanel, and they were willing to pay for it. It created something, as one Luxottica manager artfully told me, to make the needs where probably they are not. Lenses are the pixie dust of the optical business. Barely anyone knows what they are made of, how they are constructed, or, especially at the high end, exactly how they work. The profit margins within the optical business are a closely guarded secret. But insiders explain to me that while optometrists might sell frames for 2 or 2.5 times their wholesale price, it is the lenses where they make the most money, charging markups of 700 or 800%. The largest margins of all are on complex progressive lenses and protective coatings for scratch resistance or to cut out blue light, features that cost Essilor a few cents to make and which optometrists sell for between $25 and $50 a pop. Even Luxottica executives are awed by this. Nobody knows how much lenses cost, one former marketing manager said. The consumers don't know. Nobody knows. Essilor holds more than 8,000 patents and funds university ophthalmology chairs around the world. In deals that rarely make the business pages, Essilor buys up Belgian optical laboratories, Chinese resin manufacturers, Israeli instrument makers, and British e-commerce websites. Within the industry, Essilor is regarded as a kind of unstoppable enveloping tide. The question now is whether there is anyone beyond its shareholders that will be able to hold Essilor Luxottica to account. I'm not sure there is. There is nothing close to that firepower once the combination is done, said Norbert Gorny, Essilor's head of R&D. And I thought about how one of the telling aspects of wearing glasses is that they help you notice everything else, and for the most part, see the world as it actually is. But it is only occasionally, through a chance reflection, or when you really take a moment to stop and look, that you see what is sitting on the top of your nose. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in The Guardian. Read a couple of the health and science shorts. First, the Earth's coldest place. Scientists have found out just how cold the coldest place on Earth can get. A truly chilly -144 degrees Fahrenheit. NationalGeographic.com reports that freezing temperature was recorded on an ice sheet deep in Antarctica during the polar winter. The measurement shatters the previous known coldest air temperature, -128.6, recorded at Russia's Vostok weather station near the South Pole in 1983. Inhaling air that cold can cause your lungs to hemorrhage after a few breaths. So Russian researchers wore masks that warmed the air when they went outside to check on instruments. A team at the University of Colorado speculated that the temperature was likely even colder at a nearby spot where the domed East Antarctic ice sheet reaches its apex. The team used satellite measurements to map surface temperatures there and found that the air at human head height was about -137, dropping to -144 at ground level. It's a place where Earth is so close to its limit, it's almost like another planet, study leader Ted Scambo says. With Antarctica warming because of climate change, this might be the coldest air temperature scientists will ever record on Earth. No limit to longevity? If there is an upper limit to the human lifespan, we might not have reached it yet. The average life expectancy around the world has more than doubled since 1900, thanks to improvements in sanitation, health care, and food supply. Still, past studies have suggested that because of biological limits, only a handful of genetic outliers will live beyond 115 years old, such as the oldest verified person ever, Gene Kalman, who died at age 122 in 1997. But a new study of nearly 4,000 Italian centenarians indicates that human longevity may be slowly increasing. According to established demographic data, after age 65, the probability of death doubles each year. The mortality rate begins to decelerate at age 80 and, the researchers found, seems to plateau at age 105. At that point, the chances of dying in any given year are roughly 50-50. Study authors say this plateauing might be because of biological forces. For instance, cell division slows after age 100, making centenarians less likely to develop cancer. That means that as more people make it to 105, more will likely make it to 115 and beyond. If mortality stays constant, co-author Jim Vapel tells TheGuardian.com, the old age record will be broken. And we're on the Talking Points page. This first article, I should say, was published before the Trump-Putin summit in Helsinki that just happened. And it's titled, Trump and Putin, Why So Friendly? As President Trump meets with world leaders over the next week, there's no doubt which one he likes best, said Roger Cohen in the New York Times. Trump has been dismissing the NATO allies he will meet in Brussels as freeloading parasites who treat Americans like schmucks. While saying his subsequent face-to-face meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Helsinki may be the easiest of them all. Trump's ideological sympathies clearly lie with the thuggish Putin's bare-chested strongman style. He has called for Russia to be reinstated into the G7 and parroted the Kremlin's justification for its annexation of Crimea. By sneering at the post-World War II Western alliance while embracing a tyrant who meddled in our presidential election, Trump has proven he's not merely a foreign policy contrarian. He is an off-the-charts repudiation of everything the United States has stood for since 1945, including democracy, the rule of law, free trade, and human rights. Trump's NATO complaints are legitimate, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post. Germany, the richest country in Europe, only spends 1.2% of its GDP on defense, despite NATO members agreeing to contribute at least 2% by 2024. If Russia truly is a threat to European security, it's not an imposition to ask Germany to act like it. Informing NATO countries that their free riding is over doesn't make Trump a Putin stooge, said Sumantra Maitra in TheFederalist.com. On the contrary, Trump has taken a harder policy stance toward Russia than President Obama did, sending arms to Ukraine to defend against Russian incursions. Sorry, but how do you explain Trump's perverse professions of admiration for Putin? Asked Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. The hold Russia has over Trump may be worse than we suspect. Kremlin officials have been cultivating Trump since 1987, when Trump first visited Moscow at the invitation of Soviet officials, who surely surveilled his hotel room. When Trump's casino business went bankrupt, evidence suggests, he got a major infusion of cash from the Russians and may have engaged in money laundering. The Kremlin has a long history of gathering compromising dirt on prominent foreigners, so it's not ridiculous to wonder what it has on Trump. If Trump fawns over Putin because he fears what he might reveal, we are in the midst of a scandal unprecedented in American history, a subversion of the integrity of the American presidency. Pruitt, the EPA and the damage done. Scott Pruitt is arguably the most corrupt cabinet officer in modern history, said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. The newly resigned Environmental Protection Agency administrator's extensive and almost unbelievable list of alleged transgressions includes a $3 million taxpayer-funded security detail, a $43,000 soundproof phone booth, and over $160,000 in first-class plane travel, the use of top aides to help his wife find a job, and the rental of part of a Washington, D.C. condo from a fossil fuel lobbyist for a mere $50 a night. The most recent revelation was that he may have violated federal records laws by keeping several calendars to hide his meetings with industry executives. For months, the left's most hated cabinet official seemed to enjoy favored child status in this administration, no matter what he did, said Frank Bruni in the New York Times. But an irritated President Trump finally forced him out, not because he was appalled at Pruitt's behavior itself, but because it generated too much negative press. Pruitt leaves behind a devastating environmental legacy, said Umar Irfan in Vox.com. Openly hostile to the EPA's regulatory mission, he ignored scientific recommendations to ban toxic pesticides and other chemicals, lifted industrial air and water pollution controls, purged advisory panels of scientists, and widened loopholes for heavy polluter diesel trucks. Even scrubbed the phrase climate change from the EPA website. Pruitt obviously had to go, said John Fund in FoxNews.com. But scaling back the bureaucratic blob that is the EPA is very much in line with the president's deregulation agenda. That agenda will be taken up by Deputy Administrator Andrew Wheeler, a former coal industry lobbyist. Now freed from the scandal surrounding Pruitt, Trump has unburdened himself of a political liability. Pruitt's critics will miss him, said Robinson Meyer in TheAtlantic.com. With his soundproof phone booth and shameless squandering of taxpayer dollars, he was a cartoonish villain easy for Democrats to target. Wheeler, on the other hand, is a longtime Washington insider who is expected to run a more careful, by-the-book process, fashioning pro-industry policies more likely to stand up in court. He'll fade into the background while dismantling America's last protection against toxic chemicals, poisonous water, and an abundance of heat-trapping air. Meanwhile, the planet continues to warm. And just time for a couple short notes before we wrap up. First, Fox News has aired 7 of President Trump's campaign-style rally speeches almost in their entirety since April, amounting to 7 hours and 47 minutes of programming. MSNBC aired 1 rally for about 8 minutes during that period, while CNN showed none of them live. Increasing home values correlate with a drop in birth rates, a new study has found. In U.S. counties where home values have risen 10 or more percentage points, birth rates for women between 25 and 29 have dropped 1.5 percentage points. That may be because young couples postpone having children when they are struggling with expenses or cannot afford a home. Almost 6,000 pedestrians died on or along U.S. roads in 2016, up 46% since 2009. That's largely because the increasing number of SUVs, which study shows are twice to three times as likely as cars to kill the people they hit. And a quick quote from Benjamin Franklin to finish the show: by failing to prepare, you are preparing to fail. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.